You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. This is Michael Silverblatt. Today my guest is Don DeLillo, the author, most recently, of Underworld. It's published by Scribner's. His books are, should I name them in order, Americana, End Zone, Great Drone Street, Ratner's Star, Players, Running Dog, The Names, White Noise, Libra, and Mao 2. Now, this book is full of symmetries, and I wanted to begin by noting that it opens and closes with miracles, a baseball miracle and then a kind of saint miracle. And the book seems concerned in a way that people have the opportunity to believe in a kind of sanctity. Many of them are doing penance. The hero seems to be like a saint on a pillar in the desert. He has exiled himself. And I wondered, first of all, this kind of saintliness seems new to a DeLillo novel.
At some point in the early stages of this book, I realized I would be heading back into my own background to some extent. And that means to my own Catholic background. And writing about nuns and priests, something I don't think I've done before, and writing very close to personal experience in some cases. Sooner or later, I began to understand that this would begin to influence the actions of the characters and, perhaps more tellingly, the themes of the book. And there is a kind of under-history in this book. The book essentially takes place in the shadow of the bomb. But there is an anti-history. There is an anti-historical element. The book traces the private moments. It traces the memories of certain individuals. And one of the things it eventually moves toward is a kind of religious manifestation, which happens in rather unconventional ways, so unconventional that we find a miracle in cyberspace.
It's fascinating because the symmetry is very complete. The opening sections are concerned with the Bruegel painting, The Triumph of Death, the closing sections about the Bruegel painting, about children's games. Each of the sections has a sort of dark or wicked figure who receives an annunciation. J. Edgar Hoover at the beginning receiving from a messenger the news that the Russians have tested their first atomic bomb. Sister Edgar at the end, who has finally witnessed a necessary miracle. I think her miracle is finding the appearance of the street child on the billboard. And yet history is not in general something we think of as being symmetrical, or when we talk about the symmetry of history, we start thinking we're talking about paranoia. So it interests me that the book juxtaposes symmetry to chronology.
Well, you're right. History isn't necessarily symmetrical, but perhaps art is. And this is the way in which art attempts to make a certain coherent sense out of the vast, messy, three-dimensional construction that we call history.
I noticed, too, that in running chronologically backwards, the book begins in October of 1951 and ends sometime, one presumes, in the late 90s. But once it begins proper, it moves from the 90s back to the 50s. And as I was reading, I felt I was witnessing a cavalcade of literary styles and social styles, almost as if one were to speak chronologically. The book begins with a kind of language inflected by old world Italian. The kids pick it up and speak mostly the street curses of the Italians. Lenny Bruce comes along and takes the street talk and turns it into the hyperbolic, what we used to call black comic thing. And then certain stratifications happen to Bruce talk. It turns ironic and anti-hyperbolic until it arrives at the very beginning of the novel in what might be called Don DeLuise, the kind of micro-miniaturized, half-ironic, half-comic, poker-faced, and extremely concise, almost a technology of what has happened to talk. And I wondered, since this book includes necessarily a bypass into literary naturalism, or at least gutter naturalism, what it was like to come back and be writing in the style that you began by writing against.
The book has many voices, but to me, only one language, and that's American. I remember when one of my books was first translated into French, I received the French edition, and I was surprised and delighted to see a statement on the copyright page translated from the American, not from the English, from the American. And you're quite right to suggest that at some point, as the book moves backward into time, there is one section, part six, in which the prose tends to become more naturalistic. And I'll tell you an interesting thing that happened, and it didn't happen until I was reading The Galleys. I suddenly began to understand that in that part of the book, set in the Italian Bronx in the early 1950s, all the literary touches I'd used earlier in the book, the fused words, the invented words, the hyphenated words, suddenly seemed to disappear. And I, in fact, did not do this intentionally. I suppose I naturally adopted the voice of that environment and those people who lived in those narrow streets.
You know, Robert Rauschenberg, when he was seen coming back carrying a lot of fiberglass insulation, a tire, a stuffed goat, was asked what he'd been doing, and he said that I was going out buying environment. And, you know, language seems like that for you. And by now, it seems uncanny how many strands of language, commercial and otherwise, have been plied or twined into this book. Do you go out and buy environment?
I absorb it. I do go out and, you know, I can spend 20 minutes on the subway in New York and feel a kind of electricity moving through my body and mind. You stand on the subway platform under 14th Street and you see every face and hear every voice and every language. It's something I tend to take home with me. And in addition, I think I have a curious kind of audio-visual relationship with the page, with words on the page. And one reason I use an old manual typewriter is because I tend to depend on the sensuous feeling of my fingers hitting the keys, of the hammers hitting the page, and then the sense of visual correspondences between letter shapes, between letters in a given word, between words in a given sentence. I've always heard the beat of a sentence. I've heard rhythms. But it's only recently that I've become aware of this visual element in my work. It's almost as though I'm engage in an appreciation of abstract sculpture. And I sometimes put words together instinctively as if they were, in fact, two abstract units that have a visual correspondence. And just recently, 2 or 3 weeks ago, I was reading the afterword to a translation of the Odyssey. It's the Robert Fitzgerald translation. And in this afterword, he discusses what he calls the cut or sculpture of words. The first indication I'd ever had that anyone else sensed the same sort of things that I sensed.
The coming and going of time announces a doubleness, and as it happens, the same baseball that wins the game for the Giants loses the game for the Dodgers. And some of the people want the ball because it represents miracle and triumph, and others because it represents loss, or at least they have a feeling that they want it for this reason. And this kind of doubleness, you speak in the book of the punishment that pop culture exacts on the people who love it too much. And I wondered if you could talk about that.
Well, this novel is about conflict on a number of levels. Conflict between nations, between races, between men and women. It's also, in an important way, about the mystery of loss, about the durability of loss, its character-defining elements, and the way in which some men and women cannot ever get out from under it. It's as though they have found their fate, their destiny. And this is something that happens to the book's main character, Nick Shea, whose father disappears when he's 11 years old, and who eventually spends a great deal of money for the baseball in question, not because it represents a moment of triumph, but because it suggests to him the mystery of loss. It's a commemorative object in some people's view for all the wrong reasons, but not from his point of view.
The book seems to have two art gods, so to speak. One is Eisenstein, who seems to be the god of juxtaposition and editing, and the other is Lenny Bruce, who seems to be the god of hyperbole and language as object, you know. And I wondered, were they the... So much of the book is about placing one thing next to another, as you say, a close-up next to a panoramic shot. The book seems to move according to, on the one hand, editing rhythms, and on the other hand, verbal rhythms.
One wants to honor the sources of one's inspiration, and Lenny Bruce and Eisenstein, as different as they may have been, are two of these sources. Eisenstein occupies a certain place in the direct center of the book, in the middle of the book. I felt I needed a Russian presence, but I did not want to introduce a character artificially. And so I introduced a movie, the lost film of Sergei Eisenstein called Unterwelt. This movie, as it turns out, has tentacles that reach toward the beginning of the book, toward the Bruegel painting that appears in the prologue, a scene of visionary havoc and ruin. And it moves toward the end of the book as well. There is a scene in which young Kazakhstani people, young boys and girls, are shown as victims of radiation, which is a mirroring, a doubling of the Eisenstein movie we see in the middle of the book. Lenny Bruce, I sometimes wonder what would have happened to Lenny Bruce's career if he hadn't died in the mid-1960s. Had the culture changed to such a degree that he'd, in effect, seen his material become a three-dimensional thing in the world around him? Lenny needed a middle-minded, sober-sighted culture at which to level his observations. Suddenly, there were tanks in the street, students running wild. And I do tend to wonder what this would have done to his material. Lenny Bruce's language in this book tends to connect with fear, dread, and impending massive catastrophe. He does 5 comic routines during the week of the Cuban Missile Crisis and constantly reminds his audience that we're all going to die. At the end of this crisis, what does he do? Does he suggest we ought to feel fortunate that the crisis has been solved? No, he becomes somewhat self-absorbed, as he was before it all started, and ends up simply walking off the stage.
I wanted to talk about the characters in this book because they have, it seems, an additional dimension that your characters have not previously had. First of all, they have a nostalgia that is not just cultural but personal. And they are missing each other in ways that the characters haven't before. It's a very odd thing to me. David Foster Wallace called me up when he was reading the book and said, Don DeLillo has considerable sentiment toward these Bronx mafiosi. And I think he was surprised and felt that you had earned it, too. Was sentiment a source of fear for you?
I don't know that I'd call it sentiment. I do know that I did feel something more deeply than I had before. And I suppose it's largely a question of perspective. When I first started writing short fiction, these stories were set in that particular landscape in the Bronx in which I'd grown up. I wasn't very adept as a writer, and my life changed in certain ways. The environment grew larger, and I tried to write about the broader culture. It's probably no coincidence that my first novel was called Americana. Moving back to that terrain, to that landscape, decades later, gave me first an enormous sense of pleasure, the pleasure of recollection largely. And as well, it seemed to deepen the feeling I have toward the characters in that part of the book, in large part because they seemed in my mind to be so closely associated to people I actually knew. There were friends I grew up with who were not literally figures in the novel, but who nonetheless inhabited. And I think this is largely the cause of a somewhat more intense feeling I tended to exhibit.
One of the earlier novels was dedicated to the boys of, what was the number?
To the boys at 607, three male cousins I grew up with, and that was the house address where we lived. And there are probably a couple of references in Underworld to this house and to these three guys.
What I found as I was reading, now you're... Listeners are listening to someone who spent the last 10 days staying up till 4 o'clock in the morning reading Underworld. By the conclusion, it's an exalting and exhilarating experience. But as a result, when you read something intensely, certain compilates occur. And I began to get a merged or fused picture of a basic family unit, not any single one, but almost as if they were plastic slides and laid on each other, a husband and wife, an act of infidelity. This is the teacher and Clara, and then Brian Glasic, who sleeps with Nick's wife. There seems to be a quintessential act of betrayal that's repeated throughout the book in different configurations, most of the time with a terrifying anime. The characters are saying the reason why this has happened is I don't care. And it's almost as if there's a liberation moment. It's what starts to ungel the book. Nick can't help. He's not rejecting his friend, but he can't help but slapping him in the head. And it's as if this, a robot coming to care or feeling hurt enough to take this gesture, seems to free the space at the end of the book for a host of miracles and connections. Am I making sense?
Well, it's almost as though the humans are acting against the author, in a way, acting against the book's thematic material, and lashing out at themselves, at each other, and maybe at on some level at their creator. There is a strong structural balance. There is an architecture to this book. And perhaps the people in it want to engage in a kind of palace rebellion in a curious sort of way.
Could you describe that architecture a bit? Because, for instance, similarly, late at night, you know, when a book starts to come together in the mind, I remember Nick at a drug party thrown by the Rocket Heads. He's lying on the floor and he's forgetting what a shoe is. He's looking at a shoe. Several hundred pages in the book later, a teacher, a Jesuit, is sitting and going through in great detail the parts of shoes, the eyes and the tongue and the eyelid and the shaping of the leather. And it seems as if, you know, the book is held together by hundreds of cantilevered struts of this kind.
Well, this is how we began, talking a little bit about the coherence that art tries to impose on rough, unshaped experience. There are many levels of connection in this book. They kept suggesting themselves to me. And I think it all began in the prologue when the sports announcer, Russ Hodges, is announcing the dramatic home run. His voice travels through the ballpark and out beyond the ballpark and suggests a level of human connectedness which continues throughout the novel. There is such a tight fabric of connection at some point that one could almost call it paranoid. And this is what happens to the character you've just been talking about, who has taken some sort of hallucinogenic substance and begins to study the shoe that someone is wearing and believes that everyone around him is acting against his own best interests. There is a kind of interface between in this book between the real world and between the paranoid structures that people and institutions tend to build for themselves. The book itself is certainly not a paranoid structure. It merely registers the paranoia around it. And I think this element in the book culminates finally in cyberspace when there is a series of nuclear explosions that suggests that here is finally the god of our suspicion, of our distrust, and of our anime.
The book, well, comparing it, for instance, to White Noise, the final section of White Noise brings a new element entirely to the book. There's a pill that causes its own dissolution. But the prose itself, it enters a kind of almost Alaskan place. It has a strange, our crumb squiggle quality mixed with a kind of desolation that one doesn't associate with R. Crumb. But here, the book wants to come together. Not only wants to come together, but as in some centennial celebration, in cyberspace, we see not the rocket's red glare, but we see bomb after bomb going off. And suddenly, almost a jet advertisement, the word peace, comes roaring through the intertext onto the computer screen. And it seems as if, in a half-ironic way, this is the party that's going to hold this book together. However weird it seems that this drag version of J. Edgar Hoover is presiding over a file of every bomb that's ever exploded while the message is peace.
In a novel in which so many forms of conflict have appeared, I thought unironically that the human longing for peace might merit a certain amount of attention. And this is really what that word represents and what the end of the book represents. It is simply longing.
Longing is the subject of the book, isn't it? And I wondered for the longest time as I read it, I would call friends and say, I don't get it. The Dandolo I know of through his books is not hungry for innocence or childhood. And yet, for a period of this book, it seems as if that's the direction the book is heading.
I could argue that the main character, Nick Shea, does not feel a longing for innocence. He feels a longing for guilt. And what he misses in his life as a semi-retired executive living in an Arizona suburb is what he misses are those days when he could seduce his friend's girlfriend, when he could beat up kids who entered his neighborhood, when he could steal automobiles. Yes, this is a genuine longing, but I would not call it a longing for a lost innocence.
I've been speaking to Don DeLillo. His most recent book is Underworld, published by Scribner. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you very much.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Jennifer Swadek. Additional production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in bucks.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme. Now with book, off the mouse, mouth. Ah!